Welcome to the Industrial Talk Podcast with Scott McKenzie. Scott is a passionate industry professional dedicated to transferring cutting-edge, industry-focused innovations and trends while highlighting the men and women who keep the world moving. So put on your hard hat, grab your work boots, and let's go.
As always, welcome to Industrial Talk, the number one industry-related podcast in the universe that celebrates you. It is a platform that celebrates industrial heroes such as yourself because you're bold, you're brave, you dare greatly, you innovate, you solve problems, you're making my life and you're making the world a better place to live. Thank you very much. You are an industrial elite athlete. All right, in the hot seat, we've got a great conversation. I mean, a great conversation. I was really geeking out on this one. His name is Paul Holland, Managing Director. The firm is Mach 49. We're going to be talking about just VC, venture capital, and all things in between. So let's get cracking with this conversation. All right. Yeah, I like this. I'm a finance guy. Not to his level. Heck no. We were talking a lot of, I'm always fascinated by constraints and constraints that exist within sort of that financial side of a business. You have this desire. Maybe you have this great innovation. Yep, great innovation. But how do you scale it? What do you do? Who do you connect with? Who do you trust? Those are all incredible questions that you have to ask if you're in that, if you're an entrepreneur. I'm always struggling with that. I'm always looking for answers. And again, there are a lot of people out there, but you really have to do your homework to find out the ones that you want to really work with that can really not only bring solutions to the table for your company, but also just that wise counsel that is needed for every doggone business. All right. So I was very fortunate to be able to meet Paul at a wonderful event that they sponsored for NEOM. Now, I'm going to, again, encourage you in a big way to go out to NEOM.com. They're putting their mouth to practice. They are creating the community of the future. They are living a bold, brave, and daring greatly vision for what they are doing. It's exciting. That's NEOM.com. And Paul, Mach 49, and Team Mach 49, definitely, are all involved helping to achieve what they are doing out at NEOM big, big time. It's exciting. And I think I mentioned it in our conversation that it's sort of James Bondish, but it's a phenomenal, and it's taken all the stuff that we talk on here at Industrial Talk, the Industry 4.0. That's sort of like the upper level, but it's smart cities, it's 5G, it's cloud, it's quantum computing, it's everything in between and then some, right? It is truly a brave vision. It's very exciting. Go out to NEOM.com. All right, on to the interview. Now, there were a couple of things that popped out of my head when I was talking to Paul. I like the three things that they look at. One, market. Yeah, you have to look at the market. They look at the market, you need to look at that market. Does the market really sort of support what you are doing? Is it there? That's important, right? It's important. The tech, the business model, right? Is it in line? Does it work in that particular market? Does the tech even really, you know, satisfy a problem that exists in the market? Does it make it easier for them to get whatever they need to get? Does it, whatever that problem might be, does it solve it? And then, of course, the area that is really dynamic, of course, are the people. So we have the market, tech, business model, as well as people. They look at every business in that type of light. And I think that you too have to, because if you're running a business, you're an entrepreneur, you got to check the market. What is it? You know, get the right counsel for that. Your tech, does it satisfy? Are you talking at the market or are you listening to the market and that consumer? And then finally, do you have the right people in place? Yep. It seems like a simple equation, but quite frankly, companies struggle with that all the time. All right. Paul Holland, Mach 49 is in the hot seat. Enjoy the conversation. Paul, welcome to Industrial Talk. Thank you very much for finding time in your busy schedule. Love the backdrop. Excellent. You've just made me, I'm ashamed. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm speaking to you from the, technically speaking, the greenest house in America. So that's why you see the backdrop as it is. It's the lead point house.
And I'm living proof. And I have to back you up on that one because it was an excellent event. But more than don't take this any wrong way here, Paul. But I surely walked around your nice place.
There you go.
And tootled around, no doubt about it. Okay. All right, for the listeners out there, let's get cracking on who you are, Paul. Just give us a little background, 411.
There you go. So grew up back east, Southern Virginia, followed a girl out here to California 37 years ago, married her 32 years ago. And I spent my operating career helping to start two software companies. One of those was a company called Pure Software with Reed Hastings and a bunch of folks who got famous later. Doing some really cool stuff at Netflix and others. And we took Pure Software public. It was acquired by IBM for about $2 billion. I then went back to the venture capitalist who'd funded Pure. That was Andy Ratcliffe. By then, he'd started a new firm called Benchmark Capital, and he'd asked me to go to a new investment there called Kana Communications with Mark Ganey and Michael Horvath, guys better known today as Strava. I joined Kana after the Series B by Benchmark, which was done at about a $13 million valuation. 27 months later, we hit $9 billion. I was number two.
Whoa. Don't gloss over that one. What did you just say? Yeah. You said 13 to what?
Yeah. Well, it was also 1997 to 1999. And so that helped a lot. But I got brought in to run the global go-to-market. So built out a team, and we took sales from $10,000 to $132 million in 4 years. And so it was
a hell of a ride.
It was a heck of a ride. And then as Kana ran its course, I got recruited over to Foundation Capital. We spent the last 20 years there, general partner over for 18 of those years in six different funds. Foundation's a very good firm. We've invested about $4 billion of investor capital. It's currently worth about $600 billion today. Netflix is half of that, but 30 other IPOs, including some of my companies like MobileIron and Chegg and many others. And then joined Mach49. I actually started to help Mach49 when it was founded about 8 years ago. And then I joined full-time 2 years ago.
Okay, so Mach49, what does that mean?
Yeah, so Mach49 was founded by Linda Yates, who's a phenomenological entrepreneur. She grew up here in the Valley with all the folks who started the venture business. She ended up in strategy consulting, ended up at 32 years old, co-founder and CEO of a company called Strategos with Gary Hamel and CK Prahalad. Later went on the board of Sybase, took it from $3 to $65, and then about 8 years ago, decided that the Global 1000 needed their own kind of equivalent of Y Combinator. So Mach 49, Mach 37 is the speed to exit the Earth's atmosphere. And
is it really?
We use a lot of metaphors around, you know, kind of escaping the gravitational pull of the mothership and exploring new lands and things like that. And but that was taken. So she went with 49 because it's the number to escape the gravitational pull of the sun, but also a bigger number than 37, and also evokes memories of coming to California to mine for gold in 1849. She's a fourth generation California entrepreneur. And so this was an important kind of thing for her, and probably worth noting. She's the girl that I followed out here 37 years ago.
Look at that.
That's kind of squirts.
Well done.
Thank you.
So here's the deal. Industry 4.0, within just that whole topic, Industry 4.0, it encapsulates innovation technology. How do we do that? It's edge, it's cloud, it's you know, digital twin. It's all of this stuff that's just popping around. One of the areas that I think needs to be explored a little bit more is, what is the process of that you start, you know, going down that road? Somebody has this great idea. How do we begin that VC conversation, that process?
Well, if you're meaning from the perspective of an entrepreneur that's trying to get something started.
Yeah. Because there's a ton out there. If I had a nickel for every time I spoke to somebody saying that I'm a, I'm an AI expert, you know?
Yeah, sure. There you
I'd
go.
I'd be pretty rich.
Fortunately, there are more and more of them now, but yeah, for entrepreneurs, it's, you know, the first kind of, I mean, for me, I worked at two really successful startups, but both of them had been bootstrapped by their founders. Mm-hmm. And so that's a, to me, that's kind of, I'm sort of old school. I feel like that's kind of the way to get started. These days it's, you know, we often see folks that will go and do a business plan competition and they'll, you know, they'll get a nice placement in that. And then they'll turn around a week later and go out and raise money. And, you know, and that works also. I mean, there are some businesses now, particularly in places like crypto, that need to scale so quickly that they'll raise money within a month of actually formulating the idea. But for me, particularly in enterprise companies and in consumer companies, you know, I always viewed it as I saw a lot of value in people bootstrapping and putting some of their own capital at work and their own time and so forth at work. But at that point, then if you've got a strong enough idea, then you've got many different ways to approach the venture community, whether it be through you know, things like venture competitions or through you know, just kind of getting oriented around people that are doing seed investing. You know, often the best way to get involved with a good venture firm is to have a good seed investor who's got relationships in that firm. So these are, you know, these are just some of the things that folks will get started on. And as you get started on your entrepreneurial career, you'll gradually get oriented toward learning more and more about sort of the funding mechanisms, and you'll get to know folks that are in the venture industry. But you know, work on the idea and creating something amazing, and the money will follow.
See, the concern that I have and I've heard is that there's this velocity. We talk about Mach 49. There's this velocity, and somebody might have a great idea. And I hear you talking about bootstrapping. That's fine. That's good. But bootstrap means time. And in this world, there just seems to be this blistering velocity that exists within, and you're going to miss the boat. If I'm an AI guy and I have this great idea, but I'm bootstrapping it, time goes by, somebody is going to come in, some sort of fun is going to happen. Does that exist?
Sure, it does. Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, in some places it exists more strongly than in others. And so I think those are, it's the paradox around, you know, the concept of going out and raising money is that ideally you're going to be really prepared. You're going to have a lot of experience. That's why I like the bootstrap concept. Yeah. And you're going to have gone out and skinned your knee a bunch of times and perfected your offering or whatever it is that you're offering out into the marketplace. But you're right, especially in very high velocity markets like we're seeing now, you know, over the last say 2 or 3 years, then it puts more of a premium on people formulating the idea, quietly getting the team together, and then going and finding a funding source. Now, oftentimes those people are people who already have relationships in venture. And so they're, you know, I mean, I'll not to mention any names, but, you know, some of the folks that we funded are people that we are considered to be bankable from that perspective. And so when they say, hey, we're working on a new project, here's the new project. And then we start to get to know the project. We start to try to add our points of view and perspective and insights. And then if we're really excited about it, we'll fast track it through our organization and fund it quite quickly.
As a funding source. So I go down the road, I'm bankable. You like me. I've got some skin in the game. It makes all sense. I agree with you 100%. If I was an investor, I would want that too. I'm not, it's tough to, you know, just do it because I'm good looking. And then you proceed forward. How much involvement do you and other, just typical VC gets involved with the scaling of that business, the marketing of that business, the, you know, growth of that business?
Yeah, I think venture will go in and out of very heavy activity with a company, very heavy getting the initial funding in place. And then if it's an idea where, you know, the entrepreneur really just needs the time and the money to go off and develop the solution, whatever that turns out to be, then you may be in more like a weekly meeting kind of cadence from that perspective. And so it's not quite as much. For me, my area of strength was around go-to-market. And so I would often look for companies like Mobile Iron, like response software like Chegg that were in a position where the next thing they needed to do was scale. And so that's where I could bring in my expertise and my network of people who've been running sales and marketing in these enterprise companies and so forth. So for me, then I get very actively involved in helping to recruit the team, getting people on board. But then once, you know, once the organization is quote unquote scaling, you know, if you're making plan and you're out there, then you're, you know, you're introducing the customers, you're working on all these other different things where you can try to help, but it's not quite the same time intensivity of these sort of nexus points that occur along the way during different points of funding. And then of course, at the point of an exit, you know, I had a company, SkyCure, where I was the kind of the board member on point working once we had an indication of interest from a public company to be acquired. And then once you're involved in that, then that becomes sort of like all encompassing until a deal is either had or not had.
So you bring up a good point where, what is that? You're heading down the road. You've identified these quote nexus points. You're saying, yep. You achieve certain hurdles probably. It's like, yep, okay, good. Let's go. And you keep on going. Is there a point in whatever that decision is made, a point where you sort of rip that ejector seat and saying, it's not going to happen? Do you just sort of take the lumps and you go, or what normally happens in that particular case?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Scott. And I divide it, for simplicity, I'll divide it into two buckets or two paths. One path is the path that certainly I prefer, which is that you're in dialogue with an entrepreneur. You've tried a number of experiments. You've gone to market. You've gotten feedback. And basically, it's just not working. It seems like it should be working. It's logical. You're seeing other companies that have similar positioning. They're getting funded. They seem to be getting traction. And it's just not working. And you have hopefully just kind of a rational conversation of, look, you know, this isn't worth your life energy. Worth my time, but my time's minor compared to the time of the entrepreneur. And so you just simply have a dialogue that says, look, you're too good to spend time on something that you've tried and tried and you can't hit any resonant frequency in the marketplace. And then there's the other side, which is you work with an entrepreneur and they just, they've got so many kind of self-locking biases that have kicked in around confirmation bias and around all these other things, so that they're just like, you know, I've been working on this for years. Everybody tells me it should work. I think it's going to work. Look, we just got another little, you know, tidbit of good news. It's an indication it's going to work. And that's where you end up in a lot of conflict, because, you know, you've gotten involved as an investor. You're an advisor. You're often friends. I mean, most of the time you end up as friends with the people that you work with.
Yeah.
And then you're in a dialogue of just saying, look, this just doesn't, it's either not working for you or it's not working because of you. And then that, and so that's a much more tense dialogue. It's like, look, we got to try something else. And either we shut it down or we hand this over to somebody else to run and see if they can come up with some things that we haven't thought of yet. But that's a tough place to go. And the odds of pulling out of that and having it be successful, it's not impossible. And all the ones that are make the newspaper or make the news. But most of the time things aren't working and you just need to move on.
Ideally, you want to be able to have that conversation sooner than later, right? You don't want to continue to belabor a challenging business that's not achieving the objectives as you had hoped, right?
Yeah, it's a tough dynamic though, Scott. This is what I mean. I mean, you know, the third way is if you look at, you know, back when I mean, I began to work with Reed Hastings on what was a company that was called Show Software at the time, SHO with a long O, is Japanese symbol for purification. And then later, Reed changed the name to Pure Software because we had a product called Purify that cleaned up code and was just an amazing, you know, 100x improvement of what was going on in the market. And what I learned from him, working with him over, you know, off and on over a year and a half period before the company was even incorporated, is just the concept of perseverance. So this is the paradox of being an entrepreneur, and it's the paradox of being a venture capitalist working with entrepreneurs, is that the number one characteristics of success of entrepreneurs that I've seen, having seen it in person with Reed Hastings, having seen it in person with Mark Ainey and Michael Horvath, is perseverance. It's just the ability to get knocked down, get up, do it over again, knock down, get up, do it over again. A rational person would have quit 50 times before Reed had actually gotten to the point where we sold the first copy of Purify. And then by then, you know, it was like a house of fire. It was just a, it was just an amazing, amazing experience scaling the business.
See, I'm telling you, I love that. I love that perseverance. There's one side of me that always, and it, maybe it's a frustration on my mind, is that many within industry, you know, I'm a product of industry. Don't get me wrong. And I love the people of industry, but there's this conventional thinking in industry, and it is a sort of a big piece of luggage that is brought to these conversations. And it's almost, especially today, jump in if you disagree, but I think today you have to sort of put that conventional thinking. There's this desire to sort of be a little bit more disruptive. Think about that and think about how you can approach the market in a way that is unconventional. Yeah. I mean, you have to really sort, and that's hard work, especially in industry. Right. Like, yeah, you know, they don't want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of raw emotion that goes along with starting a company, working with advisors, whether they're your venture advisors or board advisors, whatever it might happen to be, and just this constant balance between encouraging and cajoling and trying to be a realistic counselor to people. And there are folks in venture that take a completely different approach to this. They just, you know, every entrepreneur is a nail and they're a hammer, which is, you know, just go, give it to your last breath kind of thing. And I'm like, yeah, sometimes that's right, but actually sometimes that's wrong. And it's just not fair to people. One of my partners, Steve Asalo, counseled a young entrepreneur out of a business that just wasn't a very good business. And the entrepreneur ended up following a passion and participated in a political campaign, ended up in the Obama White House, had an amazing life experience doing that, you know? So I think there's a balance from that perspective. And it's one of the reasons why entrepreneurs get rewarded so much, is that if you can work your way through that gauntlet of things and deal with the emotion and deal with the sleepless nights and deal with everything else. And then once the bit turns, and you know, I watched this with Mach 49. I mean, with, you know, with COVID and everything, that before COVID, Mach 49 was a very physical business where we had clients fly to California and incubate new businesses here. And watching what Linda had to do and what the team had to do to pivot to a virtual business, and now the business is literally six times bigger than it was in February and March of 20. So it's exciting when you see these things turn. I call it the halcyon days. So
see, it's interesting to talk about or hear your story about how nimble Mach 49 is, because I find, again, I think there's good and bad. There's good and bad with the pandemic. You know, we got the bad. We understand the bad, the challenges with the bad. But the good side, from my perspective, I think there was a vulnerability that existed within industry saying, I need help. I don't know what to do. This is way above my pay grade, right? I have no clue. Right. And I cherish that as much as it's painful, as much as it's created, you know, sleepless nights, it has made companies that were willing to be nimble, willing to sort of be vulnerable, boom, sort of shine and excel in this particular environment.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. I think, you know, where we've experienced that with Mach 49 is seeing large companies and seeing people at large companies that had been kind of sort of try again on their innovation efforts, their efforts to try to create new businesses to compete with the startups that are disrupting them. And there was this sort of the classic inertia and antibodies and things like that before COVID. And then once COVID kicked in, and there was this blinding flash of the obvious that if you didn't get to digital and virtual in your businesses, then you were Kodak and you weren't going to be in business anymore. And so that became kind of the bit flip that then had everybody realizing, exactly like you said, hey, we're vulnerable. Like, we need help. We need to kind of band together and sort of like kind of fight back here, because startups aren't going away. And we have to get better about being more nimble and getting out of our own way to be able to accomplish these things.
That's a tough one for industry, because typically industry is like, yeah, I've got my idea. I'm right here and I'm holding it close to my vest here, and this is why we're so great. And then all of a sudden, all of this effort here doesn't mean anything. It's like you either survive and you help collaborate with other people who are just having a problem. They might, you might have a slice of the solution, but somebody might come in and say, how about this? Hey, that's a, you know, one of those aha moments. I like it. I'm, you know, being the type of guy that I am, I like speed and velocity and moving fast and, you know, and making mistakes fast and, you know, moving on. Let me touch upon a point that happens all the time with many of the companies that I work with, as well as interview, whatever it might be. They get approached by venture frequently. And one of the areas that they always say, yeah, been there, I've talked to them, I'm not sure if I trust them. How do you approach trust within the VC community? Because some, maybe I'm not talking about mock, I'm just in generally saying there is a attitude about that. What do we do about that?
And when you say trust, in what form? Trust between who and whom?
The company and the venture firm reaching out to them and saying, hey, we can fill in the blank. If we work with you, we can fill in the blank. And, you know, you will be the next whatever fill in the blank.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think it's tough, because I think the problem is that whenever there's the perception of a violation of trust, it's so visceral and it's so meaningful to people that it gets repeated. It's the classic negative customer service experience. It gets repeated 100 times, you know, in terms of that type of thing. I mean, we were founded by founders at Foundation Capital, and so we try to pride ourselves on trying to be really straightforward with people. One of the things that we try to pride ourselves on is telling people no. There's a phenomenon in venture, and there are some very, very successful venture capitalists that were just like, that you're being a fool. Just effectively tell everybody, wow, gee, that's really exciting. Come back and see me in 6 months. And then they just say that over and over and over again. And then if 6 months later, the company all of a sudden turns out to be Google, then they're in great shape and they can kind of glom onto it. The trust aspect for us is also just having people being willing to listen to things that aren't what they want to hear, and to absorb that information. And either they can follow it or they don't have to follow it, right? They can talk to us, and then they can go down the street and talk to Menlo or Mayfield and other folks and find somebody who gets what they're saying better than maybe what we do from that perspective. So, but the trust aspect of it, you know, once you enter into a relationship and you're, you know, like if I think about it, I'll use a real life example. I funded a company called Respond Software with Mike Armistead as the CEO. Now, I had the advantage of Mike and I have been together since 1992 when I recruited him to Pure Software. And we'd done several businesses together over the years. And but, you know, in terms of like working with Mike and working with his team, there's just very high fidelity conversations. Like there was never any question, are we getting all the information we need? Are they asking for the help where they need it? Are we, you know, being transparent? Are we working hard to try to help the company? So that would have been one. If Respond hadn't worked, we would have just simply said, look, it wasn't a good enough idea, right? We, you know, everybody did what they were supposed to do. We had this trust-based relationship where everybody would show up and, you know, there was just never any question. And when you're in a trust-based relationship, then the politics also go way down. So that's also like a nice side benefit. But then ultimately, in the case of Respond, you know, they ended up having a really, you know, they got bought by FireEye and had a really, really nice financial exit that ended up out of that. So that was kind of a all's well that ends well, but it was kind of all's well all the way through for the most part in terms of dealing with the people. I've had other relationships, which I won't name, and entrepreneurs that I've worked with who will look me like right in the eye and tell me, for example, oh, when the time's right, I will definitely step aside, you know, as the CEO. And I've had situations where I've had the entrepreneur tell me that. I've had situations with where the board member that the entrepreneur had recruited into the kind of the seed stage tells me the same thing. And then we're like 6 months down the road, we've made 10% of our plan. And it's like, okay, guys, it's time. Let's got to move to plan B. Let's kick the CEO up into the chairman and let's go out. Let's get a search done and go do this stuff. And they're like, oh, no, 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 no. No, that's not what we meant. Like we still don't think we're ready. And I'm like, we're ready. Is ready when we turn the lights out? Because I don't think, you know, it's going to be kind of hard to recruit somebody in here. And it's this is what I mean. Like the human factors become huge, and you sit there and you're just incredibly frustrated. And in one particular case, I resigned from the board because I just said, look, I can't have an impact here. You guys aren't doing what you said you were going to do. You need to take a different direction, and it needs to be without me.
See, I can respect that honesty, and I can respect that truth, and that is important. In these cases where you have to sort of pull the ejector seat, and I don't want a big long dissertation on it because I know it can be really like a rabbit hole. Can you sort of distill it down to why projects fail?
So there are three aspects of what we're looking for at Foundation in a really good startup company. And so I describe it as kind of this inverted pyramid, you know, this kind of upside down triangle.
Yeah.
So at the top of that triangle are these, you know, in our case, 3,000 or 4,000 companies a year seeking funding. At the bottom of it are 10 that we fund that at a significant level. Mm-hmm. So what are there are three layers within that triangle. And the first one is market. You know, are you addressing something that has a large enough market opportunity to create a venture style return? The second one are the strength of either the technology. We used to say the strength of technology. Then we funded Netflix and we said technology or the business model. And then finally, the people. And then there's this question of like, well, why are the people last? And so, well, the people are not last, but it's in that order because that's the order in which we can change things. Like we can't change the market. Like we're not, no venture firm can really change the market. And then, you know, we can kind of change the technology with some pain and kind of change the business model. But the thing that we know we can change is that if we think the market's right and the business model's right, we can upgrade people, we can bring new people in, we can do these other things. So if I use Netflix as an example, when my partner Mike Hsu funded Netflix in December of 1998, at that time, you would argue, oh, wait a minute, well, why'd you guys fund it? It violated your market kind of axiom, right? Because there wasn't a big enough market. DVDs had about 2% penetration into American households at that point, and they were renting DVDs. But the studies indicated that market was going to get to 20 or 30% of households. Well, as now we know with history behind us, it got to 98% of households. And then that allowed Netflix to go through stage one and then ultimately stage two, what they were trying to do. But these are it's market, technology, people. And the biggest form of failure for us is what we call a small market problem. We funded something because we thought it was going to be huge, and then it just turns out not to be. And then there's technology failures, and then there's people failures.
Very, very good. Now I have to venture into Neom. I know that Mach 49 is heavily involved in Neom and the business there. Why is that important for Mach 49 and Neom?
Yeah, so Neom is of course this new you know plan to be kind of semi-autonomous territory being built out of an area in northwestern Saudi Arabia about the size of New Hampshire, just to give you kind of
it's James Bondish, FYI. It's,
yeah, all right, there you go. Yeah. So it's on the Red Sea, you know, and the idea is that the funders of Neom are basically want to build the quintessential kind of city of the future and society of the future. So think of a new Singapore, a new Dubai, whatever it might happen to be, but, you know, sort of on steroids. So 14 different sectors of activity and energy, hospitality, consumer technology, food and agriculture, all these different places. And so what Neom is about is you know, at the moment, I think it's probably the largest project in the world. It's about a $1 trillion investment project in the world. And so what we see in Neom is an opportunity to offer new forms of opportunity for people in Saudi Arabia and also just kind of more broadly in the Middle East. We see it as a way to advance the cause of clean energy, women entrepreneurs in Saudi, all these other different things that we think are good for the planet and good for, you know, sort of the growth of Saudi Arabia as a country. And at the end of it, you know, we are essentially technology service provider, and this is the largest technology project in the world. So it's a phenomenal opportunity for us to go in and help grow these sectors and help grow their approach to creating new ventures and how they manage venture activity, including some of the funding, to get them to a place where these sectors can be successful and blossom. So that's
in a nutshell. I got to tell you, man, it's a bold vision. And what I like about it is that they're addressing problems that they didn't know they had, right? They have to solve significant problems because they're building a community. They have, you don't even know the amount of problems, but what's interesting about it is that they're willing to do whatever is necessary to solve those problems to make this happen. But I look at it from a world perspective too, is that whatever flips out of that, whatever solutions take place, it has great benefits for many. And that to me is really pretty cool. But you have to have that bold, persistent drive to make it happen. Because I guarantee you, when I was speaking with some of the people at NEOM, it's like, why not give up now? I mean, it's like, oh, right, there's another problem. I'm done with the problems. No, they just keep pushing on. They keep expanding. And you're absolutely right. It is the largest project, I have to say, in the world.
Yeah. So assuming it works, we're going to see new forms of transportation. We're going to see new forms of the way people, you know, what we now think of as going to a hotel. Think of going to a, 100% robotic hotel that has these amazing experiences for you. In terms of energy, they're 100% focused on a clean energy future for NEOM. And it's obviously strategic for Saudi because they're conscious of the fact that they've got a wasting asset ultimately in terms of carbon-based energy forms. Yeah. And so, as we look at these things over time, we think that they could be, very, very exciting, and they could have broad applicability and broad benefit for humanity.
Yeah. And I one of the things that sort of creates a little tension inside of me is that I see this velocity. I see what you're doing. I see what NEOM's doing. And I see the speed at which all of this, I'll just say Industry 4.0 is happening. And I get concerned about other parts of the world who just don't have access to it, right? It's going so fast that there's no way in God's green earth that they're going to keep up. They're just not. And that to me is a point of friction for me. How can we make it for everybody? Right.
Yeah. Well, we have to hope. I mean, I've been very fortunate. Lynn and I've been to 74 countries over the course of our lives. And, I have this sort of, Pollyanna-ish belief, and I've seen it in person. Every single country has the same potential in human capital. I mean, some of the places have sort of better universities and have better educational systems and things like that. But, I've literally met and spent time with entrepreneurs in Zimbabwe and Zambia, in Nepal, in Mauritius, in all over the world. And it's the same kind of drive in human spirit. There's something almost like at a DNA level for people to want to do better for themselves and do better for their families. We have to get to a place where in many places around the world, the governments are so corrupt or they're so ineffective that they stand in the way of the human capital, their people's ability to be able to prosper. And then we have to do like significant remediation around enabling, Wi-Fi all around the world and enabling education around the world. I do think that is one of the side benefits of COVID is that, it's really, if I look at, one of my companies, Chegg, and if I look at many of the other companies in digital education, they've advanced tremendously. So notionally, if you think about it, if we get to a place you've got Starlink and you've got other things that are providing Wi-Fi all over the world, then there's no inherent reason why somebody in Angola, a six-year-old in Angola can't have access to the same educational experience as a six-year-old in Menlo Park or where it might happen to be. Now, that there's going to be differences of resources and teachers and role models and all sorts of other things that are there. But over time, I'm optimistic that we can actually make this better, not worse.
See, I agree with you. I'm pretty excited about it, right? I do. The thought of being able to have access to unlimited information, unlimited insights, and I think is exciting. And I believe countries are transformed as a result of that. And I believe that through technology and through these capable capabilities that corrupt governments will have their unfortunate role, but I think you're able to sort of use that technology to help better the lives and the communities and definitely the world as a whole. I do. I'm not frightened of the technology, even though I'm old.
Yeah. Like, well, there's a concept, and you're probably familiar with this, but you know, this has been popularized by people in the crypto community, but the, you know, there's a book called The Sovereign Individual that describes a future enabled by the information age, where you basically kind of circumvent the inefficiencies and the corruption associated with many governments around the world, and you enable individuals through information technology to achieve their goals in one form or another. Now, that concept takes on controversial elements when you apply that to, you know, billionaires, for lack of a better way to describe it. But nonetheless, it's sort of an inexorable concept. You know, we went through the hunter-gatherer age, we went through the agriculture age, we went through the industrial age, and we're clearly now in the information age. And as part of the information age are all of the things that we took with us from the last sets of things, you know, the governmental structures, the way we approach these kind of controls and things like that. Are all of those really the most appropriate ways to think about that as you move further into the information age? And I think it's going to require evolution across the board.
I think it's doable. I think the future is bright. I think that, yeah, there's going to be pain, just like anything else. But I think that, once again, back to the pandemic, maybe that was the spark. I think that we were bringing our B, maybe our CB game pre-pandemic. Now we've got to bring our A game. We've got to get past all the fluff and all of the politics and just get to solutions and solving problems. And I think that that's where we're at. Bob, we're going to have to wrap it up. I can keep on going for days. You wouldn't want to go for days. That's for doggone sure. How would somebody get a hold of Paul, Mach49, if they have any questions, comments on how to connect?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, if you just simply go to the Mach49 website, www.mach49.com, kind of scroll through, look at the things that are there. If you see things there that could be interesting for your, you know, typically work with large companies and help them create growth, as we call it, disrupting inside out, disrupting outside in, and then keep on the lookout for the next big strategy book coming out from Harvard Press is The Unicorn Within, and that's by Linda Yates, our founder and CEO. That's coming out next year.
Oh, I happen to have a library, and I better get a copy of that book.
There you go.
Thank you very much, Paul. Excellent, excellent conversation, listeners. Don't worry, we're going to wrap it up on the other side. You know you're going to be able to get a hold of Paul and everything else associated with Mach 49, so fear not. We'll be right back.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to the Industrial Talk Podcast Network.
All right. I don't even know how to unpack that conversation. There is so many gems, so many points of wisdom in that conversation. I highly recommend that you go back. Reach out to Paul. Of course, you got to go to Mach 49, of course. Now, he has a great stat card out there, Paul Holland. Put a little comment in there. Boom, Mach 49. You will find him up close and personal. Great stat card, chock full of information. All right, Neo, you got to go out. You've just got to at least begin to educate yourself about Neom and what they are doing and see how they can impact you in a positive way, but at least they're in the game, money where their mouth is. That's what they are doing. All right. Again, we're going to always have a great conversation right around the corner. However, you need to be bold, brave, daring greatly. You need to be persistent. You need to have skin in the game, and you need to do everything you can to be a success because we depend on you. Thank you very much for joining. We are going to be right back.